The Omnivore's Dilemma, Chapter 3, From Farm to Factory. Turning bombs into fertilizer. It may seem that I'm giving corn too much credit. After all, corn is just a plant. How could a plant take over our food chain and push out almost every other species? Well, it had some help from the U.S. government. At the heart of the industrial food chain are huge businesses, agribusinesses. The same businesses that create new seeds provide farmers with the tools and fertilizer they need to grow lots of corn. Agribusinesses also need cheap corn from which they make processed foods and hundreds of other products. To get the corn flowing and keep it flowing, agribusiness depends on government regulations and taxpayer money. The government started seriously helping corn back in 1947. That was when a huge weapons plant in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, switched over to making chemical fertilizer. How can a weapons plant make fertilizer? Because ammonium nitrate, the main ingredient in many explosives, happens to be an excellent source of nitrogen. And nitrogen is one of the main ingredients in fertilizer. After World War II, the government found itself with a tremendous surplus of ammonium nitrate. There was a debate about what the government should do with the leftover bomb material. One idea was to spray it on forests to help out the timber industry. But scientists in the Department of Agriculture had a better idea. Spread the ammonium nitrate on farmland as fertilizer. And so the government helped launch the chemical fertilizer industry. It also helped start the pesticide industry, since insect killers are based on poison gases developed for the war. Chemical fertilizer was needed to grow hybrid corn because it is a very hungry crop. The richest acre of Iowa soil could never feed 30,000 hungry corn plants year after year without added fertilizer. Though hybrids were introduced in the 30s, it wasn't until farmers started using chemical fertilizers in the 1950s that corn yields really exploded. There goes the sun. When George Naylor's father spread his first load of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, the ecology of his farm underwent a quiet revolution. Until then, the farm's nitrogen had been recycled in a natural loop. Legumes used the sun's energy to fix nitrogen in the soil. Other plants used the nitrogen to grow. Animals ate the plants, and the farmer recycled the nitrogen by spreading the animal's manure on the soil. But now the Naylors didn't need to produce their own nitrogen. They went out and bought it. The nitrogen for the fields would no longer be made with the sun's energy, but with fossil fuels. Farming was no longer an ecological loop. It was more like a factory. The farmer bought raw materials, seed and fertilizer, and turned it into a finished product, corn. Since there was no need for legumes to fix nitrogen, farmers could plant corn in every field, every year. Animals and their pastures could be eliminated. Farming became much simpler, like a factory. The industrial farm produces just one product, or, at most, two. And like most factories, the industrial farm is powered with fossil fuels. There's the natural gas and the fertilizer and the fossil fuel energy it takes to make the pesticides, the diesel used by the tractors, and the fuel needed to harvest, dry, and transport the corn. Add it all up, and you find that every bushel of corn from an industrial farm requires about half a gallon of oil to grow. That's around 75 gallons of oil per acre of corn. Some estimates are much higher. There's another way to look at it. Calories, like the calories in food, are units of energy. On the industrial farm, it takes about 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1 calorie of food energy. That means the industrial farm is using up more energy than it is producing. This is the opposite of what happened before chemical fertilizers. Back then, the Naylor farm produced more than 2 calories of food energy for every calorie of fossil fuel energy invested. In terms of the energy, modern farm is a losing proposition. It's too bad we can't simply drink the petroleum directly. It would be more efficient. The factory farm produces more food much faster than the old solar-based farm, but the system only works as long as fossil fuel energy is cheap. Nitrogen pollution. Hybrid corn eats up a lot of nitrogen, but farmers still feed it far more than it can possibly eat. In fact, farmers waste most of the fertilizer they buy. Many farmers put down extra just to play it safe. They say you only need 100 pounds per acre. I'm putting on closer to 180, Naylor explained to me a bit sheepishly. It's a form of yield insurance. But what happens to the 80 pounds of man-made nitrogen that Naylor's corn plants don't take up? Some of it evaporates into the air, where it creates acid rain. Some of it turns into nitrous oxide, a gas that increases global warming. Some of the extra fertilizer seeps down to the groundwater. Because of this, the Naylors don't drink the well water on their farm. When I went to pour myself a glass of water in the kitchen, George's wife Peggy made sure I used a special faucet connected to the water filter system. As for the rest of the extra nitrogen, the spring rains wash it off Naylor's fields, carrying it into drainage ditches. Eventually, it spills into the Raccoon River. From there, it flows into the Des Moines River and down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. There, in a strange twist of nature, the fertilizers wind up poisoning the ocean. The flood of extra nitrogen causes a wild growth of algae, and the algae take up all the oxygen in the water, smothering the fish. The nitrogen runoff has created a hypoxic, or dead zone, in the Gulf that is as big as the state of New Jersey and still growing. Rich fields, poor farmers. The industrial food chain makes some people very rich. Big agribusiness companies take in billions of dollars of profit. Yet one person who is not getting rich from the mountain of corn is the American farmer. George Naylor is all but going broke, and he's doing better than many of his neighbors. His farm might feed 140 people, but it doesn't support the four who live on it. They have a garden and some laying hens, but don't grow most of their own food. The farm doesn't produce enough income to pay their bills. The family only gets by because the paycheck George's wife, Peggy, brings home from her job, and because of a subsidy check from the U.S. government. If the American farmer is more productive than ever before, how come so many farmers are going broke? One morning after George had his crop planted, I sat down with him at his kitchen table and we talked about the problem. The answer is a little complicated, but it boils down to this. The price of corn is kept low by government policies. The low price means there's plenty of cheap corn from the industrial food chain. It means cheap animal feed to produce cheap meat and cheap high fructose corn syrup for soft drinks. It means corn can stay king of the supermarket. But it also makes it hard for the average farmer to stay in business, even with government payments. In the United States, the price of corn is usually below what it costs to grow it. For example, when I visited George Naylor in 2005, it cost him about $2.50 to grow him a bushel of corn. That cost includes things like fertilizer, seed, pesticide, and gas for the tractor and combine. But that year, the price of Grain Elevator Co-op paid for a bushel of corn was only about $1.45. At that price, Naylor would have lost more than a dollar on every bushel of corn. With prices like that, how can Naylor and the other corn farmers stay in business? Because the government pays them part of the difference. In some years, nearly half the income of America's corn farmers comes from government checks. It is these government checks or subsidies that keep corn and soybean prices low. Yet the payments are never quite enough to cover expenses. That's why Peggy Naylor has to have a job off the farm. That's also why a lot of farmers go out of business or just give up and retire. I asked George Naylor why he doesn't grow something besides corn, and he laughed. What am I going to grow here? Broccoli? Lettuce? The Grain Elevator is the only buyer in town, and the elevator only pays for corn and soybeans. The government will give payments to farmers for all the corn they can produce, but not for growing vegetables or fruit. Besides, Naylor has the equipment to plant corn and soybeans. He doesn't have the equipment to grow that lettuce or broccoli or anything else. George Naylor finds himself in the same trap as all the other corn and soybean farmers in America. When prices fall, the only way they can stay in business is to find a way to grow even more corn or soy. One way is to boost yield per acre. That means using more chemical fertilizer, maybe trying new hybrid or GMO seeds. Another way is to rent more farmland, maybe from your neighbor who has given up. After all, if you already have the tractor and machinery, it doesn't cost much more to farm another 100 acres or another 500. This means bigger and bigger farms, worked by fewer farmers. It means more fertilizer pollution. And it means even more corn on top of the bulging mountain of corn. And that's the catch. As farmers produce more corn, the price falls even more. Then the only thing an industrial farmer like George Naylor can do is try to grow even more corn. It's a vicious cycle. Prices go lower, but the mountain of corn gets higher and higher. The high price of cheap corn. Okay, so farmers like George Naylor are having a hard time. Everyone agrees that's a bad thing. But isn't the system still doing what it's supposed to do? Doesn't it produce cheap food for the American people? The problem is that government policies don't really give us cheap food. It only gives us the kinds of cheap food made from corn and soy. Your soft drink or hamburger may be cheaper, but that's because taxpayers have already paid for part of it. And that corn is only cheap if you don't count all the hidden costs, like the cost of pollution from chemical fertilizers. U.S. farm policy wasn't always like this. Before the 1970s, government policy was designed to support small farmers, not agribusiness. Instead of trying to keep corn prices low, government farm policy was aimed at keeping food prices and farmers' income stable. Remember the law of supply and demand? If there is a lot of grain on the market, sellers have to compete with each other for customers. They lower their prices to try to sell their grain. If there is a shortage of grain, people will pay more for it. Then farmers can charge more for their crops. Starting in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, the government began a policy to keep prices from rising or falling too much. That would protect consumers from having to pay too much for food. The policy would also protect farmers from going bankrupt if prices fell too much. This is how it worked. In times when prices were low, the government gave farmers loans so they could store rather than have to sell their crops. It bought some grain to keep it off the market. It also paid some farmers not to grow grain. When prices were higher, farmers sold their grain and repaid the government. If prices were too high, the government sold some of the grain from its storehouses. That put extra grain on the market and brought the price down. The system worked pretty well for almost 40 years. Agribusiness, government, and corn. Beginning in the early 1970s, this system was thrown out the window. Now, farm policy was aimed at one thing, keeping corn prices as low as possible. The government told farmers it would pay them for all the corn they could grow. To be exact, instead of the government buying all the extra corn or loaning farmers money so they could store it, it just paid farmers part of the cost of growing it. So all the corn the farmers grew was put on the market, driving the price down. Farmers planted even more, corn prices began falling, and with a few interruptions, they have been falling ever since. Why did government policy change to favor growing more and more corn? Did corn somehow sneak into Washington and change the laws? No, even King Corn couldn't do that. Instead, one of corn's best friends did it. Big agribusiness corporations, the same ones that need cheap corn for their mills, helped write the very laws that set farm policy. This is a farm policy that is not designed to help farmers. Lower corn prices drive farmers out of business. Small family farms get replaced with larger industrial farms. Meanwhile, agribusinesses like Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland, ADM, and food companies like Coca-Cola and McDonald's make billions thanks to cheap corn and soy. This policy makes it cheaper to buy a corn-sweetened soft drink than whole vegetables, fruits, and grains. But most of all, this policy helps corn to take over our land, our food industry, and even our bodies. That's the end of Chapter 3. Your next reading assignment will be the next edition to the Edmodo site.